Okay. The coldest I ever was for the NFL today. They sent me to the last game that the Cleveland Browns played before Art Modell moved them to Baltimore. And the wind was whipping off Lake Erie, and it was like minus 35. I mean, I didn't cover the Ice Bowl, but I remember I had to be up there early for the NFL today, and then I stayed for the game. And you know, we know Maine, we know these places, we know cold, don't we know? And I've been in Lambeau and Soldier Field, and I've been plenty cold in my career. Kansas City is cold, but I will tell you the coldest I ever was that last game in Cleveland.
Well, yeah, this is all of that cold without the excitement of a big game.
Well, we don't know. Colby Bates, maybe they got some up there.
There you go. Well, Leslie, the book is absolutely wonderful. I couldn't put it down. I read it in one night. The title, Sometimes You Have to Cross When It Says Don't Walk, A Memoir of Breaking Barriers. And that title comes from something your mom said to you when you were about 11 years old and announced your career plans.
Yeah, thanks for asking. My family moved a lot when I was a kid. My not that people would ever know this, but my father grew up in Amsterdam under the Nazi occupation. He was not Jewish, but they were all starving. I mean, he went to Montessori school with Anne Frank, and you know, he said, "Boy, in America, there's so much opportunity, and don't take that for granted." And we were living in Cincinnati, although I'm a native Bostonian, but we were living in Cincinnati. And I said to my mother, I want to be a sports writer, which, you know, that was so bizarre. It was like saying, I want to go to the moon, you know, or I want to be a Supreme Court justice. Thank you, Sandra Day O'Connor. But I said, I want to be a sports writer. And instead of saying, forget it, this is in the early 60s, she said, that's great. Sometimes you have to cross when it says don't walk.
Well, great advice indeed, and you followed that. Now, you mentioned growing up in your early years in Boston. I enjoyed reading about that, and you talked about the three things that everybody loves and talks about in Boston: sports, politics, and AM radio. And I laughed because the other day on our show, we had a guy who was huge in Boston radio back in the day. Dick Summer was on with us.
Of course, of course. I mean, how do we get to know the Beatles when older than most of your listeners? But gosh, it was AM radio, and you were either BZ or WMEX, and I was a woo-woo Ginsburg kid. But yeah, AM radio is where, you know, you heard the music. And of course, I grew up with the Red Sox. I mean, I couldn't believe I live in Florida now. My husband is from Ohio, but he was actually the captain of Harvard basketball, Bob Knuth, but he retired down here. So it's so strange down here, because what was the one thing the Red Sox needed? Stanton. Stanton is what we needed.
That's
but he
right.
went to the Evil Empire.
Now, you mentioned your husband, captain of the Harvard basketball team, although you tell in the book that when you met him, you didn't believe it and said, how come I never heard of you?
Oh, I can't believe you told that story. Of course, most people know I was married to the great Dick Stockton, who called Carlton Fisk's home run. That was the night I met him, and Dick was great. Dick and I were married for 26 years, just ran out of gas. But yes, I met Bob Knuth, and when Rick Pitino introduced us at the Kentucky Derby, he said, meet a friend of mine. He was the captain of Harvard basketball. Now, I've covered 35 Final Fours, so, you know, I work with James Brown, who was the captain after my husband of Harvard basketball. So I stuck out my hand, and I, you know, you could just see my New England spine going up, and I said, captain of Harvard basketball? I don't think so. And my now husband looked at me and said, you must have missed 4 years. Which is true, because, you know, now Harvard gets to the tournament. Of course, my husband, we text Tommy Amaker all the time. But, you know, at the time, you can't say yourself. No one was following Harvard basketball.
Now, I also, a number of things that stood out to me in reading the book. One is apparently our shared affection, although perhaps with different motivation, for former Giants running back Tucker Fredrickson.
Yes. I hope people buy this book because it's about anybody who had a dream, which you're going to have to share with me what your dream was, but mine was just sports. You know, other kids love poetry or love music, but I just love sports, and I finally got around to writing this book, and it's on Amazon and, you know, eventually bookstores. But yes, I loved Tucker Fredrickson, and, you know, in Boston, we don't really follow college football, but, you know, Tucker was, I think he finished second in the Heisman, you know, from Auburn. And, you know, he was just great. And I got to know him because, of course, he went to the New York Giants. So I got to know him later. And now I consider him a friend. But yes, I mean, wasn't Tucker Fredrickson kind of, you thought, because we didn't follow college football in Boston, but if you did, didn't you think Tucker Fredrickson was great?
I did, and up here, before the Patriots really caught on in the early and mid-60s, we grew up in this area, many of us as Giants fans, and so you know, Tucker Fredrickson was the great hope, along with guys like Joe Morrison and Bobby Duhon and, gosh, even Norm Snead.
Yeah, and don't forget Chuck Mercine,
who, of
course, had played at Yale and then played in the Ice Bowl. So, yeah, no, I knew the Giants, too, as a kid. The Patriots were, it's so astonishing to me, and I'm so close to that organization. They've been so great to me. But, you know, when we grew up, they were really bumbling. Remember, they would play in different stadiums, and who was the player? Remember the time they called him out of the stands, that he'd been cut, and
right.
He was up there drinking in the stands, and they said, report to the locker room, and his friends, who was that? They wondered where he went, and then it was so-and-so on the tackle, right?
Right, yeah, I can't remember. You wrote about him in the book. I can't remember
who
it was.
Yeah, I can't think of him. But they were such, you know, the Patriots, when we all started, they were, you know, if you had pride in the NFL, it was the Giants.
Well, the Patriots, we're talking with Leslie Visser here on Downtown. Patriots are, of course, the model organization these days, and part of that is because of the work of Robert Kraft, who was incredibly helpful to you, but not in his role as owner of the Patriots, but going back to the Lobsters, for people who might have forgotten them.
Yeah, thanks for mentioning that. I think Bud Collins, the great Bud Collins, came up with that idea, lob and tennis, the Lobsters. And he came up with the little cartoon insignia. You know, it was a great team. It had Martina. She had defected. She wasn't yet a citizen, but she had defected. And Robert Kraft decided, wow, I'm going to own this team. They played in Walter Brown Arena. Nobody came. But for me, what a privilege. I mean, I did go on to cover 15 Wimbledons, mostly with Bud, and 25 U.S. Opens. So I know most people identify me with either basketball or football, but I had the privilege. I even went back with Martina. It was interesting. She had come from Prague, as many people know, and she won 5 or 6 straight Wimbledons, and not one word was written because she had defected, and under the old Soviet regime, you were considered a non-person. So not one word had been written, but she went back as a member of the Federation Cup, which was like the Women's Davis Cup, and I got to cover it, and she had not been back to Prague since she defected, and it was really interesting that it was a rainy day. I remember we had to make a connection in Frankfurt on Maliv, which you've probably never taken, Hungarian airline, Maliv Airlines, and it landed in Prague, and of course she took the steps down on the bottom, pouring rain, but thousands of people went there because they heard the great Martina was coming home, and they stood behind chain link fences, you know, really taking on the government, but with kids on their shoulders, you know, just to get a glimpse of Martina Navratilova.
You've had so many remarkable highlights and continue to in your career. One of them that's fascinating to me in your recollection of it in the book is being there for part of the coverage when the Berlin Wall came down.
Really profound for me. As I said, my dad grew up in Amsterdam. Everybody was starving. And so I just had a really small piece of the pie of the coverage. But in November of 89, what had happened, for people who don't know, is that the the exit strategy, people were starting to go through Hungary, and East Germany realized, wow, you know, we're losing everything. We're losing scientists and doctors, and my little slice of the pie was athletes, because you remember the great Katarina Witt. She had been from East Germany, and of course all the swimmers won all the gold medals. But there started to be this mass defection through Hungary, and they realized, oh my gosh, we're losing control. So we better, of course, Reagan had been there before to say, Brezhnev, tear down this wall. And to be there was so astonishing. Before it actually broke, we went into East Germany through Checkpoint Charlie, and it was amazing how, like, little things, you know, roll towel, toilet paper that we take for granted in the Western world, you know, all of a sudden it became the roughest, lousiest paper. And, you know, it was just 100, 200 yards, whatever, the wall as it was built up. But it was really profound to see people. They walk for days, you know, they walk from Potsdam and Dresden just to get through that wall. And you know, my little, of course it was Walter Cronkite was the main, our main reporter, but I just had a little slice of the pie, but I didn't care because I was there.
You have had so many firsts in your career. You've opened so many doors for women these days, certainly an increased awareness of the struggles that women have faced, really in every kind of work. Is what we're seeing, the Me Too movement and all of this awareness today, is this, do you think, a turning point? Is this a bump in the road? Will it make a difference and finally help make the playing field level for women in all lines of work?
Yes, I do, but I don't know if it's dream to. I will say that it's in every industry, and women have just had enough. They've had enough of not being treated equally. I will say that although players, you know, hit on me every day. Same thing for Jackie McMullen, same, they were the bubble after me. But, you know, there's no women in my business that hasn't dealt with it. But the people who made my decisions, I owe my career, as always being the first, I owe my career to four men. One, Vince Doria of the Boston Globe, and then three men from CBS, Ted Shaker, now my chairman of CBS, Sean McManus, and the great Les Moonves, who's the CEO of CBS, and not one assignment or one economic decision. I cannot say that for my career, which is 40 years now, none of that was dependent on harassment. So, you know, I'm really hoping. I guess I wrote this book because I think you can have a dream. I mean, And maybe your dream was to be, you know, a sportscaster. Mine was a sports writer. But women now can grow up and say, wow, I want to be a sports writer. I want to be a sportscaster. I want to cover the Red Sox, or, you know, I want to cover the World Series. I want to cover the Super Bowl. And they actually don't have to stand down and think, wow, this is going to be a really long haul.
You talk about so many wonderful colleagues you've worked with through the years in the book. Can you share some memories of the great Dick Enberg, who we lost just recently?
Oh, thanks for asking about Dick Enberg. I was privileged to, I first met Dick Enberg when I was at the Globe, and he was doing NBC, the Final Four, with the great Al McGuire. By the way, how about Al McGuire? Because I did get to work with him later. Al McGuire, I remember once at dinner, Al McGuire said, kamikaze pilots, I don't get it. Why did they wear helmets? Isn't that brilliant?
That is great.
So, no, I've worked with brilliance. But yes, Dick Enberg, I think I did three or four NCAA tournaments with him. And I can remember one that we did. It was Dick Enberg, Bill Walton, and myself. And we had Arizona in the tournament. And Luke Walton, of course, a great coach. But Luke Walton was playing at Arizona. And Bill Walton started ripping him on the air. You know, and you have to picture Bill Walton's voice, right? Walton, that's a terrible pass. What are you doing, Walton? What are you doing? Are you out of your mind? And Dick Enberg had to say, now, Bill. He had to be the father. I'm sure he's doing the best he can. But he was a gentleman, a scholar, a doctorate, and a storyteller.
You've talked with us about Will McDonough and how much he meant to you and so many others, and that incredible Globe staff that you were a part of that the several have acknowledged is maybe the best in the history of sports journalism.
Yeah, I think Sports Illustrated did name us. I was the end of the tale, but they acknowledged those years as the best sports section ever. It was Bud Collins on tennis, Peter Gammons on baseball, Bob Ryan on basketball, Will McDonough on football. And it was interesting when CBS first came to me, they came up to the Globe and offered me a job on the NFL Today. You know, obviously Brent Musburger, they were huge. And I said, why would I leave the Globe? And they said, you've got to be kidding. I mean, there are only 20 of these jobs in America. But the Boston Globe taught me a couple things. One, don't take the floor unless you have something to say, unless you're going to report something or you have an anecdote or you're going to introduce something into the conversation. I mean, these people ever to this day, and I'm in my 60s, I've never met more brilliant people, more committed people. It was such a privilege. And I started there at 19 and I couldn't possibly have known how great it was.
By the way, that move into television was fictionalized by the great Dan Jenkins. I didn't know about that until I read it in the book.
Yes, Dan Jenkins. And of course, we love Sally. Sally Jenkins was in that bubble that had Jackie McMullen and Christine Brennan. I mean, really, for a little bit there, it was like as good as it gets. But Dan Jenkins, you know, at that time, people didn't go from print to TV. They were very distinct industries. And I don't know that one had that much respect for the other. And so in the book, You Gotta Play Hurt, Dan Jenkins has me fictionalized. And he says, what do you want to spend the rest of your life saying, back to you, Jim Nance? which, of course, is what I've done for 30 years. So it was an honor to know Dan Jenkins, and I'm very good friends with Sally.
I loved it, too. Late in the book, I stumbled upon an excerpt of one of my favorite poems, Halfway Down.
Yes, Winnie the Pooh. Halfway down the stairs is the stairs where I stop. It isn't at the bottom and it isn't at the top. That's one of your favorite poems?
Absolutely. I saw that. I went, wow. No wonder I like Leslie so much. Tucker Fredrickson and A.A. Milne.
Well, you know what? He was a brilliant and a, what was he? Lewis Carroll was the mathematician. But A.A. Milne, I think he was a professor at Oxford or Cambridge, and he just did this to entertain his son. But I do think this, John Madden actually taught me this. You're not going to believe this because this is so unlike John Madden. He said, all you need to know about life is if you read Peanuts every day.
That's not bad advice right there. The book is delightful. It's such a great read. Sometimes you have to cross when it says Don't Walk, a memoir of breaking barriers. And in the book, you talk about, Leslie, that we all in life have two resumes, our professional resume and our moral resume, the way we lead our lives. And I can say from the interactions we've had through the years, you are all aces in both because you've been so kind and so generous with your time to everybody through the years and continue to be a role model, not just for women, but for men and for anybody who wants to pursue their dream.
Wow, that is so honorable of you to say that. Yeah, I used to think, gosh, I have to represent the Globe. I have to represent the Visser name, then I had to represent CBS, then I had to represent all women. But finally, we've come, Chris Brennan and I, and Sally and I, and Jackie and I, we laugh about this, that, you know, we used to all be on each other's Christmas card list, and we said, gosh, we really hope there are enough women that, like, I don't know half of them now, and I think that's great.
Well, We Need to Talk is a fabulous show. The book is a great read, and we're so happy that you are still such a vital part of the industry and so appreciative of you making time for us yet again, Leslie. Thanks so much.
Thank you, too. Call again.
Thanks, Leslie. I appreciate it. Stay warm.
Talk soon.
All right.
Thanks,
bye-bye
Rich.
Now.